Blog Talk Radio.
The alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, the alt-right, do they have any semblance of guilt?
A local World War II veteran wants you to hear and see this next story because he's worried what he fought against so long ago is making a comeback here in the United States.
He believes what happened.
Hi. In this video, I'm going to talk about how to recognize a fascist. To begin, let's take a look at what fascism is. Contemporary fascists share three core beliefs. One, people of European heritage are or ought to constitute a biological, cultural, and political unity known as the white race, sometimes dog-whistled as Western culture. Two, Jews are masterminding the destruction of the white race through multiculturalism and non-white immigration, a plot that fascists call white genocide or ethnic replacement. Three, the only way to save the white race is to establish a white homeland, or ethnostate, from which non-whites and degenerates must be purged. Now, as I've argued in past videos, all three of these beliefs are false. So what is it that's attracting people to fascism? Well, let's take a look at a contemporary Nazi propaganda video and see if we can figure that out.
Who are you? I'm not talking about your name or your occupation. I'm talking about something bigger, something deeper. I'm talking about your connection to a culture, a history, a destiny. Our ancestors had a very strong sense of their identity. They could say, I'm a Roman, I'm a Saxon, I'm a Dane.
Good news, boys. You no longer have to be some schlubby fuck riding the escalator at IKEA, thinking about how much you hate your job as a marketing and communications associate, because the sun has risen on the day wherein you take your father's claymore in hand and defend Voltaire and adorable blonde children against black civil rights. You know, just like the Vikings did.
We're often told that being an American, or a Briton, or German, or any European nationality, is about being dedicated to a collection of abstractions and buzzwords. Democracy, freedom, tolerance. multicultural. But a nation based on freedom is just another place to go shopping.
So, life is basically sad. And in capitalist society, that sadness is a sense of isolation, an anxiety that there's nothing more to life than acquiring 1990s collector's edition Tampa Bay Buccaneers / Slim Jim beer steins until you die. Fortunately, thanks to fascism, you don't have to. Fascism promises you a part in something greater than yourself, a homeland for your people, a sense of belonging to a tradition that stretches back thousands of years, and as far into the future. Just be sure to be extra proud of the parts of your heritage that involve buying and selling other human beings as property. The most basic way to resist fascism is to recognize its propaganda for what it is. The idea that appreciating European culture is in some way linked to establishing a white ethnostate is just nonsense. Your enjoyment of Beethoven or white babies or whatever it is you get off to is in no way impeded by the proximity of people with different skin colors and traditions. And it certainly does not require nation, culture, and geographic ancestry to all become the same thing. But in order to recognize fascism, you need to do a lot more than reject the most overt propaganda. In the wake of the disastrous alt-right rally in Charlottesville earlier this month, the Nazis have been driven back into the shadows. At least two of their major websites were shut down, Confederate monuments were removed all over the country, and several prominent fascists have begun backpedaling. None of this means fascists will go away, it just means they'll have to be more subtle and indirect. Shortly after the Charlottesville rally, a post titled Fixing the Alt-Right appeared on Poll, the image board where millennial Nazis talk strategy and trade pictures of Japanese nymphettes. The post outlines some basic fascist strategy.
Don't get trapped in an echo chamber where you can no longer relate to normies. Pretending that Charlottesville didn't massively push the average white person away is really stupid. We have a chance to actually make changes now that Trump has shifted the Overton window to the right, but we need to be smart and make the movement appealing to the average white person.
And the way to do that is...
disavow all Nazi/KKK edgelord LARPers. There is no way to lose public support quicker than going around making Nazi salutes and holding tiki torches while chanting Jews will not replace us. This instantly makes the average person hate you. Build a populist movement with realistic, incremental, overt goals. Repealing the 1965 Immigration Act and replacing it with something that both limits total immigration and prioritizes white immigration is an actual, tangible political goal. Keep the long-term goals covert and don't ever reveal your power level. Talking openly about a white ethnostate only leads to failure and the average public turning against you. So disavow anyone who reveals his power level. Leftists will recognize dog whistles and know we're crypto, but normies won't listen to them.
So at first glance, this seems like a really silly, juvenile post that references Dragon Ball Z, but it actually displays a sense of realistic pragmatism and an incremental approach to long-term goals that I wish were more common on the left. But of course, the strategy described here isn't new. Older generations of white supremacists have been doing this stuff for decades. When overt racism is politically unacceptable, politicians have to use coded language in order to appeal to racists. Republican strategist Lee Atwater explained the technique in an interview in 1981.
You start out in 1954 by saying by 1968, you can't say that hurts you, backfires. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. You're getting so abstract now that you're talking about cutting taxes and all these things that you're talking about are totally economic things. And a byproduct of them is that blacks get hurt worse than whites.
So if you want to recognize a fascist, you have to know how to read subtext and how to hear dog whistles. Because 99 times out of 100, a fascist will disavow fascism, racism, and white supremacy. At least when talking to you, a non-fascist. Rallies with swastikas and Nazi salutes are the exception, not the rule. Fascists are more likely to gain traction and are hence more dangerous when they use subtler tactics. So for the rest of this video, I'll be describing the particular strategies that fascists use to code their ideas and make them more palatable to conservatives, centrists, and liberals. Strategy 1. Outright denial. Never reveal your power level. Disavow anyone who reveals their power level. This means that if someone acts like a fascist, has fascist beliefs, repeats fascist talking points, and hangs out with other fascists, The fact that they publicly denounced fascism should be worth absolutely nothing to you and shouldn't even enter into your consideration of whether they're a fascist. After all, "I'm not a fascist" is exactly what a fascist would say. Strategy 2. Euphemism.
"Of course I'm not a fascist. I'm an alternative ethno-nationalist simply trying to preserve Western values."
Fascists constantly shift their terminology in order to avoid the negative connotations that develop around the names of their movements whenever people figure out what they really are. So they insist they aren't Nazis or white supremacists, just white nationalists or alt-right. But as people catch on to the fact that white nationalists and the alt-right are just Nazis, they'll shift their terminology again and start telling you,
"I'm not a white nationalist, I'm an identitarian,"
or whatever the next thing is. But it's still the same bastards, they're just using a different name. They'll also use euphemisms for core components of their beliefs. If talking about preserving a homeland for white people sounds too fascist, they'll talk about preserving Western civilization or Western culture instead. If the phrase white genocide discredits them, they'll say ethnic replacement instead. And if it's considered hate speech to advocate purging non-white people, they'll talk instead about purging immigrants, criminals, rapists, and terrorists, and leave it to the audience to catch the color coding on their own. Strategy 3. Pedantry.
"It's absurd to call me a Nazi. The German National Socialist Party hasn't existed since 1945.
That's right, and I bet he's an isolationist, too, not an expansionist like the Nazis. Fascists use this kind of selective pedantry to dodge derogatory labels, and also to bog you down in a petty terminological dispute. This is a good way to waste your time and divert your attention away from whatever led you to call them a Nazi in the first place."
"I'm not a white supremacist. I don't think that whites are superior to other races. I simply think we deserve a homeland of our own, as do all peoples."
There it is again. And next he's going to tell us that since Asians have the highest IQs, he's, if anything, an Asian supremacist. And then you'll get sucked into arguing about IQ, instead of talking about the fact that the main goal of the politics he supports is the political and social supremacy of white people over all other Americans and Europeans. In other words, white supremacy. Strategy 4. Secret symbols. Nazis have always taken an interest in occult symbols, like the black sun on Fritz's ring, or like the swastika itself. But more obscure symbols can be useful as a kind of secret handshake that lets Nazis recognize each other without normies taking notice. The best symbols to use for this purpose are ones that are not primarily associated with fascism, or at least have some other meaning, such as the Asala rune or the Iron Cross. Better still are symbols that, until adoption by fascists, are completely innocuous. Modern fascists have taken to using almost arbitrary emoji as a way to wink and nod at each other, notably the frog after Pepe, the milk, and the OK sign. So it doesn't matter what the symbols are. In fact, it's important that the symbols constantly change so that normies don't catch on. By the time you watch this video, they probably won't even be using the frog anymore. Maybe it'll be this, or this. The only way to find out is to watch fascists carefully and see what symbols they use to identify themselves. And of course, another advantage of using innocuous symbols is that when leftists try to point those symbols out, the fascists can always say,
"These gullible SJWs now think that even the OK sign is racist. Is there anything they don't think is racist?"
And the gullible centrists will be taken right in. The poor centrists. They're so afraid that Antifa is going to punch them because of their hair or their emoji. And you know, some leftists are assholes or idiots. So I should say, you should never assume someone is a fascist just because of their hair or because of the emoji they use. These are only little pieces of a larger puzzle. But white centrists also need to understand that the way you feel about Antifa at political rallies, "Oh God, what if they profile me and attack me unfairly?" That's how a lot of black people feel about the police all the time. And the fascists whose free speech you defend so often are trying to drum up exactly the sentiments that make the police dangerous to black people, and that make it dangerous for queer people to be themselves in public. So, I hope that's something you think about. Anyway, it's not that the OK sign is inherently racist or that anyone who uses it is racist. And in fact, it's its very innocuousness that makes it useful as a crypto-fascist wink and nudge. But the misunderstanding about calling these little things racist sets the stage for Strategy 5, Camaraderie of the Accused.
The left accuses everyone of racism. They think all white people are Nazis. If it's acceptable to attack and censor me, they'll come for you next.
Fascists have very effectively exploited the general hostility towards social justice warriors, especially online. Unfortunately, not all leftists have my connoisseur's eye for detecting fascism, and some of them do throw the label at centrists or liberals. This doesn't cause centrists to become allied with fascists. History shows that happens regardless, but it can accelerate the process, lending some plausibility to the fear that moderate centrists have that anti-fascists will come after them next. It's tactically smart for fascists to make the most of this situation and use it to pump up sympathy and solidarity from centrists. Strategy 6. Irony, jokes, satire, and memes.
Of course I wasn't actually being racist. It was just an edgy meme. Can't anyone take a joke anymore, or will the Antifa fascists violently attack you over humor now, too?
Here's a uniquely millennial twist on the racist dog whistle. You shroud your sincere ideas in cartoon characters and memes, and then when called out, you mock your accuser for being a clueless normie who isn't in on the joke. Sometimes irony can be a safe way to explore ideas that you're not quite ready to own yet. Before I realized I was transgender, I used to jump at any opportunity to cross-dress ironically. So when you see people joking about being Nazis, they could just be joking, or they could be using irony to partially conceal the truth. It's difficult to tell the difference, and that's the point.
But Kekistan is just a satire of identity politics.
Well, it's a hilarious satire of civil rights movements that just happens to use a Nazi battle flag. And while it may have been popularized originally by goddamn centrist YouTubers who are unable or unwilling to see how helpful they're being to fascists, Kekistan became the perfect pseudo-ironic pretext for, identitarians, including the ones who led the rally where an edgy shitposter hilariously memed his car into a crowd of people. No wonder the SPLC now describes it as a hate symbol.
Those normie fools. It's just a joke.
Strategy 7. Shifting blame.
Why doesn't the mainstream media cover violent anti-white organizations like Black Lives Matter or Antifa?
This is essentially just a tu quoque fallacy, especially heinous because of the equivocation between fascist violence and anti-fascist violence, and between white nationalism and black civil rights. The implication is that activism to reduce urban poverty or violence against black people is just the mirror image of white supremacist ethnic cleansing. Shortly after the Charlottesville incident, our proto-fascist president called out Antifa and the alt-left, a term fascists invented to distract liberals and centrists, and establish the assumption that there must be some leftist equivalent of the alt-right. Because if you have a word for a thing, that thing must exist. Both sides' rhetoric is useful to fascists because it diverts attention away from them, vilifies anti-fascists, wins sympathy from centrists, and helps to shift the center of acceptable discourse in their direction. Strategy 8. Incrementalism.
Charlottesville, then Pittsburgh.
Multiple casualties inside the synagogue.
Is your sense that there's new energy joining these movements?
It's probably the most active of my career.
Frontline and ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson investigate.
Wanted to talk to you about what you were doing in Charlottesville last year.
Who was behind the violent rally?
This video of you launching yourself into that crowd.
You could feel how angry they were, but also how happy they were to be intimidating people like this. And it was just this happy rage.
We're down to dive home, man.
And uncover a network of white supremacists across America.
Yeah, we think he's serving in the Marines now.
News organization ProPublica.
Tonight on Frontline, the film that led to a wave of prosecutions. Documenting hate, Charlottesville.
Tonight's program contains mature content which may not be suitable for all audiences.
Charlottesville, Virginia, August 12, 2017. I've been tracking hate crimes since the presidential campaign, and I could see that something was happening in this country. The Charlottesville rally was supposed to be about a Confederate monument, but anyone who was paying attention could see that it was about more than a single statue. It felt like a national reckoning around race was coming. And being here would help me understand it. I came here to ask questions. But as the day unraveled into chaos around me, one thing became clear. This was not a place to listen or understand. Charlottesville was a crime scene. In Charlottesville for what would become the largest gathering of white supremacists in a generation. They called it Unite the Right, and it was drawing individuals from at least 35 states.
Good afternoon. I'm Chief Thomas, Charlottesville Police Department. We will have a significant police presence throughout the weekend. Well over 100 officers from my agency, several hundred officers from the Virginia State Police. We were informed that the National Guard is monitoring this situation.
The day before the rally, a few reporters gathered for the police press conference. But I'd begun to hear from other sources in Charlottesville.
We have time for one more question. Chief, we're hearing rumors of there being another torchlight march tonight, an unpermitted march. Do you have any information about that?
I've heard the same rumors, but I don't have a lot of details. What have you heard? Where is that going to be taking place?
We've been
in the city or the county?
5 or 6 o'clock.
We're at?
Not far from here is what we've been hearing.
The police had heard the same rumors I had, but the university grounds were quiet, and it seemed like the march might not be happening after all. Until suddenly, the torches appeared. In a matter of moments, hundreds of neo-Nazis and white supremacists assembled and marched on the university. The police arrived on the scene, but watched from the sidelines as a small group of anti-racist activists were quickly surrounded. One of them, Emily Gorsensky, was streaming it from her phone.
We are pinned in. We are surrounded on all sides by hundreds of Nazis. We have no way out.
Where are you, friends at?
We outnumber you. We outnumber you. We run this.
White lives matter. White lives matter. White lives matter. White lives matter. White lives matter.
I got punched. I got kicked. I remember getting hit in the head. I thought it was with a torch.
I stepped forward at one point, and I got shoved back.
I thought I was going to die. The thing that I was thinking as the melee was happening was, I just need to keep the camera going, you know? That was the only thing that I could do. Yeah, it was like 100 people beating up, like, a small group of us.
And 10 or 15 people.
Yeah. You could feel how angry they were, but also how happy they were, you know, to be doing this, to be intimidating people like this, and this happy rage.
Had you ever seen that displayed before?
No. Never in my life. They were cheering, they were running through the streets, yelling at people, and they walked away and they got away with it. They're coming in here the next day, ready to do more. I thought, like, here we go. Yeah, here we go.
The morning after the torchlight march, I walked into town with a group of clergy. The white supremacists who'd beaten people the night before were returning. And anti-fascist counter-protesters were arriving to challenge them.
Hey, no fear! White supremacists are welcome here!
No hate! No fear!
White supremacists are welcome here! No hate!
No KKK! No fascists here!
At 10:15, a melee erupted. A group of white supremacists, some with their hands taped up like boxers, punched, kicked, and choked people who tried to block their path, leaving them bloodied on the pavement.
Just want to let you know there's been all kinds of crazy violence over here. Pepper spray, people beating each other with sticks. We're trying to figure out if the police are going to intervene to stop that or if it's just going to keep going on.
Well, we've all got different assignments to try to maintain some sort of order here, so that's what we're focusing on right now.
Hundreds of people had shown up to protest the white supremacists. Most were nonviolent, but some, black-clad, militant anti-fascists, had come to fight. And while police looked on, the crowd grew more aggressive. A group of white supremacists formed up with shields and clubs and pushed straight into the protesters. Some of them fought back, but no one was arrested and the violence continued to escalate. At about noon, a group of white supremacists cornered protester DeAndre Harris in a parking garage next to a police station. They beat him with poles, metal pipes, and wooden boards.
Hey! Hey, y'all cops, why is somebody dying in here? Come do your job! Come do your job! Come do your job! Come do your job!
Police did not intervene to break it up. Then at 1:45, the brawling turned into something else. An act of terror. A gray Dodge slammed into a crowd of protesters. 20 people were rushed to the hospital. 32-year-old Heather Heyer was pronounced dead.
I always wondered, was she afraid? Did she see him coming? She was deaf in one ear, so, damn it, I wasn't going to cry. She had planned on not going. But when she saw videos from Friday night, she said, I have to go. And when you drive through Charlottesville now and see that peaceful little downtown, it's really, really hard to imagine. Even seeing the videos, it's surreal. I get cold chills every time I'm in the parking garage and have to walk past where Dre was beat up. That's just insane. Right there by the police station. The police standing right there.
For you, what does justice for Heather look like?
I don't know. I don't know that you could ever call it justice for Heather. Nothing's going to bring Heather back. Those of us who miss her forever. her best friend said, you know, it's kind of weird. I'll get to be an old man, and she'll always have been 32. You know, life goes on. I'm getting older. It's just weird. Life is very different.
James Alex Fields is the person who's been prosecuted for Heather's murder. In your mind, is he the only person who should be held accountable?
No. For people from 35 states to come in to fight, that's absolutely absurd.
You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. Nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides.
It was really something else to see. This news conference, Bill, encapsulated the president's thinking, his reasoning, and frankly, his frustration over the events that took place over the weekend in Charlottesville.
He defended his initial comments and said there is plenty of blame to go around on both sides. Specifically, he mentioned what he called the alt-left.
Excuse me. What about the alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, the alt-right? Do they have any semblance of guilt?
Today, David Duke, the former Grand Wizard of the KKK, tweeted this.
Grateful to the president for his words today.
Thank you, President Trump, for your honesty and courage to tell the truth about Charlottesville and condemn the leftist terrorists in Black Lives Matter / Antifa.
Here in Charlottesville, one white nationalist told us the president has helped them.
He's opened up a door. His movement has opened up a door. But it's up to us to take the initiative.
President Trump's comments sparked national outrage. While white supremacist leaders praised the president's words, they angered many here in Charlottesville, including the city's mayor at the time, Democrat Mike Signer.
Groups that previously had been stuck in the shadows and at the margins and at the extremes were brought into the mainstream, and that's why they felt welcome to try and unite the right in Charlottesville. At the end of the day, it's a city of, you know, just under 50,000 people, and we were this target for forces much, much bigger than us.
You are the Jewish mayor of a small southern town. I imagine you've gotten a lot of trolling and a lot of harassment.
Oh, yeah, hundreds of messages on Twitter, mail at my house, a cartoon of Robert E. Lee pressing the green button on a gas chamber where my face had been photoshopped into it with a Star of David on my lapel in reference to the Confederate statue issue here in Charlottesville.
I saw you that night over at the county government headquarters, and you looked stricken.
Stricken is not a bad word for it. I wish that we had known more. I wish that we had been given more information by the state intelligence apparatus.
Did they say anything like, hey, these guys are going to come with clubs, they're going to come with pepper spray, they're going to come with, you know, implements of violence?
No. We had one briefing with three members of the Virginia State Police who came and talked to us on city council. They did not present us with any evidence of a credible threat.
As I understand it, about 10 people altogether have been prosecuted from those days. Does that sound accurate to you?
It sounds like it should be a lot higher.
Unite the Right was a watershed moment for the white supremacist movement. Groups that had been isolated on the margins for years suddenly converged out in the open. An independent report commissioned by the city said the many failures of state and local police had produced disastrous results that day.
I just wanted to see if there's anything the Charlottesville police could say about what happened that day and what changes might have been made going forward.
Okay.
Charlottesville police won't talk, and the state police won't either.
I got your message saying that basically we should look at the Facebook and Twitter posts you put out, but we have questions that go beyond that.
They've charged one man for the killing of Heather Heyer and four for the beating of DeAndre Harris. But if Charlottesville was a crime scene, then most of the criminals had gotten away.
Like I said, I'm just trying to figure out how many folks have been prosecuted and how many cases might still be in the pipeline.
I wasn't getting any answers in Charlottesville, so I set up on my own. Who were these white supremacists who had descended on Charlottesville? And why did the authorities seem so unprepared? I arrive in New York to meet with a retired FBI agent, a man who infiltrated neo-Nazi groups during the 1990s.
This is from Charlottesville.
Mike German tracked the violence in Charlottesville as it unfolded.
This is when the police should be there, and they aren't. And not even in view. I mean, you can't even see somebody close by. I mean, it's one thing to, okay, watch these guys trade some punches and then follow them as they separate and grab them.
Right.
They weren't even doing that. Or let them go home, but then pick them up.
Right.
You can identify them
right.
Pretty easily. And what's interesting about Charlottesville is that it was after almost 2 years of increasing violence at these protests. There was Anaheim, Sacramento. The first Berkeley protest in 2017. Huntington Beach protest. The second Berkeley protest was even more violent. The fifth, sixth, seventh in a series. I could see from my office here in New York City how this was building. This was not just predictable, but predicted. I couldn't believe that there wasn't better intelligence being provided by the federal government, by the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, particularly when people are coming in from out of state. They should be warning them. These are people who engaged in violence in Berkeley. These are people who engaged in violence in Huntington Beach. Where was the FBI? And unless the FBI, too, has just abandoned this ground, which I would find even more shocking.
And your sort of sense is, like, if you allow folks to go out and act very violently over and over and over again in these political spaces, then they basically start to think, hey, the cops are okay with us.
Right. They're going to protect me coming in, let me do it, and then protect me going out. Now that these groups feel that they have some state sanction for that, they are going to be a lot more dangerous in the coming years.
Where was the FBI, Mike German wondered. It issued warnings about white supremacist violence before Charlottesville, but those warnings had failed to stop the bloodshed. No one from the Bureau will sit down with me, but they sent me a statement. The FBI said that while it doesn't police ideology, it has long investigated white supremacy extremists, and it will enforce the rule of law. Stabbings, shootings, beatings. At rally after rally leading up to Charlottesville, I see the same faces again and again. One face stands out to me. I first notice him at a pro-Trump rally in Huntington Beach, and he surfaces again at other rallies where he's treated like a leader. After he's briefly detained by police, I'm finally able to identify him. Robert Rundo is based in California now, but his rap sheet begins back east. That's where he led a small street gang in Queens, New York, called the Original Flushing Crew. The Queens DA shares Rundo's file with me. Rundo's Flushing Crew wasn't racist and included a few Latino members. They got into a bloody feud with the infamous street gang, MS-13. Within MS-13, Rundo was known as El Diablo Blanco.
In 2009, he was filmed by surveillance cameras in front of this corner store. Runda's crew can be seen chasing members of MS-13. Rundo stabs one of them. His victim falls as he tries to escape, and Rundo stabs him 6 more times. Rundo's graffiti remains on sidewalks here, but he's gone. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison for gang assault and sent upstate. After his release, he moved to Orange County, California. The neat rows of sun-bleached homes here look like a vision of suburban utopia. But Orange County has always had a darker side.
This is actually Clan Robe.
So is that like the...
The guy was a Grand Dragon of the Imperial Clans of America. The rank structure here.
So kind of like sergeant stripes or
something? Yeah, like that, but he's like in charge. He ran this whole chapter and the whole region. And stuff.
Lowell Smith was an Orange County probation officer for 26 years. For much of his career, he worked exclusively with white supremacists.
So the guy we're looking at, Rob Rundo, he has this tattooed on his back. Can you explain the significance?
Well, the Totenkopf has primarily found what we see with neo-Nazi organizations. We've seen back in the day started off with Adolf Hitler, with the Gestapo, and back to some of the Nazi secret police.
Wow. So this is a thing that I've been trying to understand. Rob Rundo, he grows up in Queens, New York. He's a member of kind of a multicultural gang. He goes upstate to New York State Prison, and by the time he gets out of New York State Prison, he is definitely on the path to being a neo-Nazi or a white supremacist.
There is a lot of hate within the prison system. There's a lot of assaults, fights, racial fights. So they go in there and they separate by race for protection. So for these guys to be protected, they gotta be allied for protection with hardcore violent skinheads. Then they go out to the streets, they're ideologically motivated.
So it's not surprising to you?
It doesn't surprise me at all, no. Over time, especially within the last year or so, a couple of years, I've seen this whole white supremacist thing becoming more emboldened.
Just in the last couple of years?
Yeah. It's probably the most active in my history, in my career.
So in almost 30 years?
Yeah, and a little bit different, too, because you're seeing mainstream that you wouldn't suspect. You're seeing college kids becoming emboldened in this movement.
So moving out of the subculture and moving into the mainstream of American life.
Right. It worries me a lot. Yeah, I'm really... concern. I am afraid Charlottesville could happen again and be a lot worse.
Smith says a new generation of white supremacists are pushing their politics into the mainstream. Rob Rundo seems to be part of that trend. His group's first public appearance wasn't at a torch march. It was in Huntington Beach, at a pro-Trump rally, behind a banner that read, "Defend America." When anti-fascists showed up, Rundo and his crew attacked them. He pinned one of them on the ground and pummeled him. One member of his crew also attacked Frank Tristan, a journalist with Orange County's alternative weekly paper.
At the time, did you know that this was a group or who did this or what was going on?
No. I definitely saw they were organized. They stuck as a group. You know, they also the banner. When we got back to the office and I started talking to Gustavo about everything, he started having me go out and look for everybody there who was attacking people. I started going through hashtags, so like hashtag MAGA March.
You.
Yeah, right there. So started finding pictures like this.
So is this him hitting you? Is that later?
So this is right after he had just hit me. When I clicked on his name, it took me to his profile.
And you look at and his picture is there,
mm-hmm.
And you say, oh, that's the dude who attacked me.
There you go.
I said, okay. If we're going to tell this story that actually there was white supremacists there, we need to get everything right. So start digging. Then I start seeing pictures that photographers took of that MAGA march. and I see a guy with a shaved head and a jacket, and immediately I'm like, that's a Hammerskins logo, walking around openly with a Hammerskins jacket. And so then he starts digging. He finds out that this guy had actually been just recently released from jail, from prison, for a hate crime. And that's when you know that they're, okay, this is more than just a couple of random people. There's something much more organized.
Frank and Gustavo followed a trail of social media posts and court records. Their research put a name to Rob Rundo's group, the Rise Above Movement, or RAM. They portray themselves as patriotic nationalists, but the members' Facebook posts are full of anti-Semitic and racist imagery. They also appear in photos and videos training with the largest Nazi skinhead gang in America, the Hammerskins.
So you got a Hammerskin here hanging out. They're doing their fight training with the Rise Above Movement.
So they're training and they're not identifying separately. It's all under the same moniker.
And so basically you have like a new white supremacist group kind of absorbing the old guard.
Yes.
And the old guard being known as being hyper-violent.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So what happened with these guys in the weeks and months after the march and the attack at Huntington Beach? Where did they go?
They started getting more prominent. They started getting more well-known and more celebrated.
And they started becoming friends with other alt-writers. They're becoming heroes.
Oh, check it out. If anyone wants to know, this is what we're about. It's Rise Above Movement. We were at Berkeley, at Huntington. Now we're here.
That's right.
In the months after their emergence at the Huntington Beach Trump rally, the Rise Above Movement's social media following swelled. By the time of the Charlottesville rally, they'd gained a national reputation as white supremacist street fighters.
There were a couple guys in these few shots that we weren't able to identify. I wonder who he is. He looks like he's part of RAM.
He's definitely a RAM person.
Dressed in the whole thing.
But I don't think we know his name, no.
I know Rob Rundo is the leader of RAM, and by examining online videos and court documents, I'm able to identify several more RAM members.
So there's this guy who I don't know if you guys know who he is now.
Oh, okay, so leave that on him, and
yeah.
Then come over to this video, to the Charlottesville.
Oh, yeah.
One face looks familiar, and I quickly realize where I've seen him before. He marched in Charlottesville on August 12th, his hands taped up for a fight.
Oh, look, he's got his right hand taped up.
Right hand.
I wonder if his left hand is as well.
I'm sure we can see. Oh, yeah, he has both here.
They're the same person.
Yeah.
The RAM member can clearly be seen attacking people at the California rallies. And in Charlottesville, he participates in one of the morning's first fights, beginning the escalating spiral of violence. But whoever he is, I can't identify him. Using clues from RAM's propaganda videos, I managed to locate one of their training spots. Just off the 405, outside of Irvine, we find RAM's graffiti tags hidden inside drainage tunnels.
Traditionally, when you looked at white supremacist graffiti, it tended to be the opposite of this, so not the flowery large letters that's associated more with hip-hop culture. White supremacist graffiti traditionally tended to be more just like narrow letters, just like the lettering there. I'm guessing this is like the New York City influence, like Rob Rundo bringing this from Queens and his upbringing. Here's my guess. I mean, it looks that way.
Sociologist Pete Simi has studied white supremacists for decades. His field research takes him inside dozens of racist groups across the country.
I describe them as a hybrid of sorts because they're kind of a collage in a way, you know, where they're pulling together these different ideas and symbols and associations and kind of making their own thing. This is the life rune. How does it get appropriated by the white power movement? It's all about white survival. So this is one that's been in circulation for a long time. Yeah, National Alliance used it back in the 70s. So what do you make of this? Got the Celtic cross. It's one of the most widely utilized tattoos among white supremacists. And then it's interesting because you get then this
phrase here, kill your local drug dealer, which taps into what's right above the straight edge, the 3X, triple X's. This notion of living a clean life and being very kind of puritanical, right, almost. They felt like they were doing like a vigilante type work, where they were cleaning up the streets.
Like the white supremacist who came before them, Simi says that RAM members present themselves as defenders of traditional white culture. We visit Marblehead Park in San Clemente, where they film training videos that celebrate personal fitness, the warrior spirit, and political street fighting.
What they're trying to sell is this idea that we need to go back to a more traditional time, you know, traditional masculinity. When they blend in these fight scenes, that's also this idea of being not only just fit and living a pure life, but also being a warrior of sorts. And so you could imagine a, you know, 16, 17-year-old white male watching these videos and being somewhat moved by them or attracted to them in some case.
It looks like it's a small group, it's a fringe group. Why are they important? And what do you think?
Well, first, you know, the first thing is, if we just want to strictly talk about violence, small groups can do as much, if not more, destruction than large groups. If you have, for instance, the Oklahoma City bombing, relatively small group there that, you know, ultimately pulled off at the time the largest act of domestic terrorism prior to 9/11. So you know, an act of violence can certainly be committed by a small fringe group. And then I think, yeah, they might be kind of a small fringe group. But the best, most sophisticated white supremacist is the one who appears the least visible. They're not out there wearing uniforms that are going to be really visible. They're not getting tattoos all over their face. You know, they're blending in a lot of different ways, in including the issues they're concerned about. The issue of immigration, which has been a real hot-button issue. White supremacists can seize on that issue and say, look, there's an invasion, and America's under siege. Then they have the potential to recruit among a much broader swath of the population than we often are willing to admit or recognize.
A couple months after Charlottesville, I had enough to publish a story and a video about the group, naming Rob Rundo and several other members. I later hear from several law enforcement agencies, including the FBI. They won't talk on the record, but they say they've opened an investigation into Rundo's group. I want to talk to Rundo. I go looking for him and learn that he's in Europe, networking with extremists there. And I still can't identify that RAM member in the Charlottesville photos. The one wearing the Make America Great Again hat and punching people in the face. Then I get a tip from a local cop. The man's name is Michael Macellis. Macellis doesn't have a criminal record. He's a PhD candidate at UCLA and holds a government-issued security clearance for his job at the massive defense contractor, Northrop Grumman.
Hey, Mike, how you doing? AC Thompson, ProPublican Frontline. Wanted to talk to you about what you were doing in Charlottesville last year.
Sorry, I don't know anything about that, man.
But you were there. You're on camera. You're on photos.
No, I think you got the wrong
Hey,
guy.
Do Northrop and UCLA know you're involved with the Rise Above movement?
There we go, man.
We identify Michael Macellis in a follow-up story. And the next day, Northrop Grumman announces it's taken action. And Macellis is no longer an employee.
City, an Army veteran who police say is an admitted white supremacist has been charged with murder as a hate crime.
Portland police say late yesterday afternoon, three men were stabbed by a man yelling ethnic and religious slurs.
Over the course of my reporting, I've seen a wave of white supremacist violence hit the country.
The brutal killing was motivated by prejudice.
after police found Urbanski belongs to Facebook group Alt-Right Nation.
Police departments across the country have reported a steep rise in hate crimes. The FBI says that hate crimes have hit a five-year high. One case draws my attention.
Prosecutors say Samuel Woodward took Bernstein to a park and killed him with a knife.
Bernstein was found with more than 20 stab wounds.
20-year-old Woodward was the last person to have seen the pre-med student while he was home for winter break.
Do you think your son could have been targeted because he was Jewish?
Absolutely. He was also a gay man.
Samuel Woodward hasn't been charged with a hate crime, but the case seems worth investigating. And it took place back in Orange County, California.
I've been looking at this guy, Samuel Woodward, the man accused of killing Blaze Bernstein in this park. At first I thought, you have a gay Jewish college student stabbed to death. Maybe this is a hate crime. What do you know about Woodward?
Woodward was a teenager, grew up in luxury in Newport Beach, so that's the old money of Orange County. His family were very devout Catholics. They went to one of the wealthiest parishes in Orange County, Our Lady, Queen of Angels, conservative Catholic parish right there.
So you've been tracking white supremacist groups for many years now. Was Woodward a guy who was on your radar? Do you know of him to have been involved with any long-term OC groups?
Nothing. You have Volks Front here. You have Hammerskins. I knew the traditional neo-Nazi groups. I had no idea who this guy was.
Woodward didn't seem to be on anybody's radar here, and he didn't appear to be part of any local white supremacist group. His alleged crime was vicious. But it wasn't clear to me that he was even part of my story.
Anything else the court needs to address on behalf of the people?
No.
On behalf of the
Sam Woodward betrays no emotion at his court hearing. He pleads not guilty.
Defendant is Woodward.
Okay, go ahead and write down.
I pull Woodward's court file, but there are precious few details in it. There's also not much to be learned from his schoolmates. They describe him as an introvert, and it seems like most of his life took place online. Orange County is starting to feel like a dead end. Then I hear from a journalist, Jake Hanrahan, who gives me photos of an anonymous Twitter account showing Sam Woodward doing paramilitary training with a neo-Nazi group called Adam Waffen Division. My colleague Ollie Winston manages to make contact with the person who posted the photos. He's a former Adam Waffen member, and he points me to another member who uses the online handle, Ted Bundy. We trace him back to his parents' house in a DC suburb, a neighborhood favored by members of the intelligence community. He uses Nazi imagery on his Facebook page, posts selfies with guns, and I've obtained photos placing him in Charlottesville.
So I'm a reporter with ProPublica and PBS Frontline, and we're working on a documentary about the new neo-Nazis.
This is a Nazi emblem, the Black Sun. This is a T-shirt put out by the group Adam Waffen.
His father will neither confirm nor deny that the pictures on his son's Facebook page are real. But the next day I get a call from his family. They say he left the group, that it was too extreme for him, and he hasn't had anything to do with it for months.
I think you should be aware that one of the people in the group that he was involved with is currently facing charges for killing a gay Jewish college student in Southern California.
Their story is difficult to verify. Adam Waffen is obsessed with secrecy, communicating through encrypted text messages and private chats using a service called Discord. The former Adam Waffen member sends us logs of 250,000 messages shared amongst the group. Ted Bundy is in the logs,
and so is Sam Woodward. But something unexpected catches my eye, and I have to go back to Charlottesville. At the Torch March last August, Emily Gorsensky had been assaulted while she live-streamed the confrontation. We'd traded information, but there were new details in the Adam Woffen Discord logs.
You were sending me messages when I was in California, mm-hmm. and I think you and I were both wondering if it was the Rise Above movement that came after you on the night of the 11th. Then my colleagues and I got the chat logs for Adam Woffen, this like much more extreme neo-Nazi group. And this guy, he's talking about Unite the Right, and he's reporting back to his fellow Nazis. And he says, just got in a fight. If you see a guy in a tracksuit, that's me. I drop-kicked Emily Gorsensky. This guy describes kicking you by name, with your full name. Mm-hmm. We think this guy in the tracksuit, it's this guy, Vasily Pistolis. He's a private first class in the U.S. Marine Corps.
I mean, that's unbelievable. So there is somebody with a tracksuit. We have photo of him. And if we look, we can see him back here. You're going to see the Adidas tracksuit.
That's the guy.
This is the guy. And then he comes running in from the back, does a flying drop kick. Yeah, and he doesn't hit me because the person he hits is a few feet over to my right. But he definitely does come in and launch himself at people. And that's kind of what kicked off the whole group.
And that's where things got crazy.
The melee, yeah.
If you look at this picture, I think it's got to be the same guy.
Oh, that's him, yeah. Man. I mean, look at the haircut. That hairline is super distinctive.
It's got like the total widow's peak. So at the same time, he would have been attacking people. He would have been working for the U.S. government, serving in the Marines.
The military bans membership in racist groups, and the Pentagon publicly condemned the violence in Charlottesville. But while reporting on Pistolis, I get an email from a Marine veteran.
Shortly after Unite the Right, a friend of mine came across a comment by Pistolis on Facebook and immediately clicked through to his profile and realized this kid's an active duty Marine and you can't be a Nazi in the military. She sent the screenshot my way because she knew I had served and she thought maybe I would be able to get in contact with his command.
Ed Beck served a tour in Iraq where he'd been assigned to the 2nd Marine Logistics Group, the same command Pistolis serves in at Camp Lejeune.
After I was first alerted to Pistolis, I started searching and just came across other websites that he had been posting on for years, white supremacist content, racist content, anti-Semitic content.
Beck had seen the same footage I had of Pistolis at the Torch March, and he'd collected video from Charlottesville I'd never seen.
He had posted a photo of his costume that he was preparing for Unite the Right.
So it's the Punisher baseball cap.
The Punisher cap, the flag, the mask, which he ended up not using. I started digging into photos and videos. You can see Pistolis on the side.
Right.
He turns and starts advancing, and he gets ready to swing.
He was everywhere in these images.
Right in the middle of it. And here's one shot of him attacking.
Oh, wow. I had not seen this. This is insane.
There are multiple videos showing Pistolis attacking.
Wow. He's hitting the guy on the ground, right?
Right.
It's vicious.
But there were at least a half dozen videos that captured his attack on Saturday.
What made you finally decide, like, I have enough information here to call law enforcement?
Pistolis popped up at the White Lives Matter rally in Shelbyville, Tennessee. That night, a neo-Nazi group assaulted an interracial couple.
There's Pistolis.
There's Pistolis. The Nashville police were looking for witnesses. At this point, I realized I had to report him. I called the military police at Camp Lejeune. I told them I had evidence that he'd been a Nazi for years and that he had assaulted multiple people at the Right in Charleston.
And you said this all on the phone call?
I said this all on the phone call.
And what happened?
He said he'd send it up the chain and they might be in touch. And I never heard back.
I speak to the Marine Corps several times. They tell me they'd opened an investigation into Pistolas, but it came to nothing. I made contact with Pistolas over email, but he denied even being in Charlottesville. He tells me to call him.
But what we see in those chats is very explicit plans to, as they put it, hunt anti-fascists. Very explicit plans to procure mission, I guess is the right word, like pellets for these guns that would do the maximum damage, glass pellets, or should we freeze them? Can we get pellets that contain gas? Very explicit discussions about weaponry, about how to do the most damage, and what I would call incitement to homicide.
One day, all of the facts in about 30 years' time will be published.
When genocide has been carried out in this country almost with impunity, and when it is near to completion, people talk about intervention.
They will be met with fire, fury, and frankly power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
Welcome to Angry Planet. I'm Matthew Galt.
And I'm Jason Steele.
What's the difference between a Proud Boy and a Boogaloo Boy? Are Patriot Prayer and Patriot Front the same thing? If I wear a Hawaiian shirt while eating a bowl of Lucky Charms, does that make me a member of a far-right group? How many of these tactical bearded weirdos are there really, and are they dangerous? If it feels like the world today is weirder, wilder, and grosser than the one in the past, I feel you. 2020 has seen an explosion of far-right groups, and if you find it hard to keep track of all of them, you're not alone. Luckily, our guest today has been keeping track of many of them. So here to help us order and sort the Proud Boy from the Boogaloo is Jason Wilson. Wilson is an independent journalist whose work has appeared in The Guardian and Bellingcat. Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on one of my favorite podcasts.
That is so nice to hear. Thank you. Obviously, we were talking a little bit before we started recording, but we had discussed talking about taxonomy of the different far-right groups and linking it to the John Birch Society. About a week ago, we were going to talk, and we're recording this on October 1st now, a couple of days after the first presidential debate, and one of those groups was called out during the presidential debate. So I think we have to talk about that. So you've been following this a lot. I think you literally published something with The Guardian right before we got on the air about this group. Who or what are the Proud Boys, and why were they being talked about during the presidential debate?
The Proud Boys are it's best to just cut to the chase now and say they're a kind of shirt movement, I think, and there are parallels between them and the shirt movements that we're seeing in various countries around the world in the interwar period. So they call themselves a men's fraternity, a drinking club. They call themselves Western chauvinists. And they were formed by Gavin McInnes, who was a founder of Vice, has long since left, and is now a fairly fringe conservative media figure since he's been deplatformed and thrown off a number of social media services and also CRTV. He was broadcasting on that. But anyway, he got this group together and they do drink together. Just a couple of weeks back, they were in Las Vegas for their annual West Fest. But the reason that they're of such concern to people is that they're also fond of violent confrontations with the left in American cities. And in particular, in the city where I'm based, the city of Portland, Oregon, over the entirety, really, of the Trump administration, we've seen Proud Boys coming into town and getting into fights with anti-fascists. Yeah, they have been, the story I published this morning is based on the Blue Leaks trove. I pulled some stuff out of that, and your listeners may have heard of that. That's a rather large data breach associated with the Fusion Center that happened in June of this year. And what I found in there was that a number of agencies, including Fusion Centers, which are the kind of, they're a national network of state-based information sharing type institutions that put federal, local, tribal, state agencies together and put them all in the loop with the same information. And they're part of the country's counterterrorism infrastructure. Anyhow, I found Fusion Centers, local police agencies, federal agencies, all talking about the Proud Boys in terms of they're a white supremacist group, they're an extremist group. There was I found an advertisement for law enforcement training in Orange County, California, where they were being, you know, treated as a gang and thought about as a gang along the same lines as the Hammerskins or the Rise Above movement. There are a lot of agencies taking these guys really seriously as a violent extremist group. Yeah, and look, what happened on Tuesday night at the debate came after they had mobilized nationally to descend once again on the city of Portland. So they had a rally in Portland on the weekend at a park on the city's northern fringe. They were originally going to come downtown, but they changed the venue, possibly to take it off federal property where it was originally scheduled to take place. And possibly also they may have been told by various agencies that it would be preferable for them to do something less confrontational. In any case, that was in response to a shooting homicide that happened in downtown Portland on the 29th of August, when a guy called Aaron Danielson, who was a member of another group, Patriot Prayer, who's another right-wing street fighting group here in the area, where he was shot dead by a gentleman who identified as an anti-fascist, as Antifa, and that his admitted killer was later himself on the 3rd of September shot dead by police. So I guess I would say that the Proud Boys have been integral to this cycle we've seen in Portland over the entirety, really, of the Trump administration, where local right-wing activists engage in incursions I say incursions because mostly they're not actually from Portland. They're from outlying parts of the metropolitan area or parts of small town Washington and Oregon. We've had incursions by them into the city, acts of provocation. Eventually, at some time in the summer, this results in some kind of catastrophic or heinous act of violence. And then national Republican politicians get involved, national groups like the Proud Boys get involved, and then they stage this kind of spectacular sort of intervention into the situation, and Proud Boys will come into town from all over the country. That's the immediate mood to the president's remarks, probably what was on Joe Biden's mind, the reason that he raised it. But yeah, the Proud Boys are not only integral to events in the city of Portland, but they've really been a consistent element of the kinds of street confrontations and contentious rallies that we've seen in the country throughout the last 4 or 5 years.
What are we talking about when we're talking about numbers? Because what I've read was the rally in Portland was something of a damp squib, and only a couple hundred people showed up. How does that compare with their actual numbers?
Yeah, that, as you say, they only really, my estimate was around 350, but that would include locals and media. There was a lot of media here, a disproportionate amount of media possibly. But yeah, let's say they had a couple of hundred. I think the biggest crowd I've ever seen the right bring to Portland was probably in August 2018, when it would have been something like 500 or 600, mostly Proud Boys. In terms of their national numbers, it's probably not correct to describe it as a mass organization. I would imagine it's somewhere in the four figures and maybe not even the high four figures. I would say there's probably several thousand of them throughout the country. The problem is, though, if enough of them descend on your town, and there's something particular about Portland, I think, about its size. It's not the biggest city, so that they can have a disproportionate impact here in terms of a disruption. But yeah, I would say it's several thousand. I didn't mention some basics initially either. They're identifiable by, they wear black Fred Perry polo shirts with gold fringes on the collar. And last week, actually, the Fred Perry company said they would no longer be selling those shirts in the United States because of their association with the Proud Boys. So they also tend to wear red Trump hats. And there are people in the organization, like one of the de facto leaders now, I guess, Joe Biggs, who are military veterans. There have been some instances where serving police officers have found to be involved with the group. And in fact, one in Vancouver, Washington, which is just over the Columbia River from Portland and effectively part of the metro area, a deputy there was fired several years back because she was involved in the Proud Girls, which I guess is the women's auxiliary organization, when she was selling merchandise associated with that group. The numbers aren't huge, but if they can concentrate those numbers in a city like Portland, they can cause some real problems. I think the worst instant, I reported on Charlottesville for The Guardian, and obviously that was a terrible day because of the homicide, the vehicular homicide that happened at the end. But in terms of the street fighting, Charlottesville was not as bad, in my opinion, as what happened on the 30th of June 2018 in Portland, where they had a kind of pitched battle with anti-fascists in the streets that police totally lost control of. And that day, your listeners can find video of that day. I saw six, seven, eight people attacking someone prone on the ground, Proud Boys attacking anti-fascists who'd fallen on the ground. There was an infamous kind of punch thrown by a guy who goes by Rufio Pan Man in the movement, where he struck this resounding blow to an anti-fascist who was lifted off their feet and then sprawled on the ground. And that moment became a huge recruiting tool for this group. But yeah, that was a terrible day. And I think another terrible day was this year on the 22nd of August, when a number of Proud Boys and associated people came into the downtown area and they were shooting paintball pellets directly and indiscriminately in a crowd of leftist protesters. One journalist, Robert Evans, who I actually have written with, he had his hand broken by a Proud Boy with a folding baton that day. It was an extremely violent day, and they also destroyed a snack van that had been catering to protesters downtown. So that was a very bad day as well. And people who, I didn't actually cover that one, but people who were there also compared that day to Charlottesville and said it was maybe a more dangerous situation because, you know, there were guns drawn and stuff. So this movement is all about violence, really. There are degrees of membership in the group. And the details there, some of them are silly. One of the degrees involves getting beaten up by other Proud Boys when you try to recite the names of breakfast cereal. But the fourth degree of membership nuanced the language around that. But it used to be explicitly that you had to engage in violence and carry out an act of violence in the course of movement act. The language now is more euphemistic. It's something about sacrificing something for the movement, but everyone knows what it means. And so you had this situation, especially in 2017 and 2018, where you had guys coming to cities like Portland so they could get their fourth degree. So yeah, it's a movement that's all about violence. I don't lightly compare it to the shirt movements of Central Europe in between the wars. It's a very similar kind of purpose, which is a kind of, they see themselves as political enforcers and they're personally loyal to the president. They explicitly define themselves as a pro-Trump group. And look, while their stated politics on their website and stuff may not be seen extremist in the context of Republican politics in 2020, the preparedness to use violence, I think, is what defines them as an extremist group. And yeah, I think they're capable of enormous disruption and enormous harm if they're able to concentrate their numbers in a particular way, just because of their fondness for violence.
Will you define for the audience what a shirt movement is?
Oh, sure. Yeah. The most famous probably are the black shirts associated with Italian fascism, and then the brown shirts or the SAE associated with Nazism in Germany. And those groups, we look for a lot of the time, the discussions about, there have been discussions obviously about whether President Trump is a kind of fascist leader. And they often get bogged down in details about ideology. If you read scholarship on interwar fascism, the exotic theories of race really aren't necessary to defining fascism. All necessary is this kind of eliminationist idea about some kind of national enemy. Italian fascism, until a long way into the war, was not violently anti-Semitic in the same way that Hitlerism was. But what they did do was go around trying to find leftists to beat up. And that was effectively what the black shirts did ahead of Mussolini seizing power. They defined the national enemy as socialists and other leftists, and they went around beating them up. The mass politics of the 1920s and 1930s were very different to the politics of today. Those societies, for one thing, were much younger, just in terms of the average age of the people who lived in them. And the spectacle of mass gatherings was a big part of that politics. So things have changed slightly. And I'm not saying that, you know, the Proud Boys exist on a scale that the black shirts did in fascist Italy. But it's a very similar purpose and a very similar ethos. And it's not the kind of thing that you want to get out of control, let get out of control in any society, I don't think. So they're a paramilitary or militia group that's dedicated to street fighting with the perceived enemies of their movement and their leader.
I'm wondering about how these new groups, when you mention militias, relatively new groups, I guess, how they match up against, let's say, the Michigan militia of the late 90s, Timothy McVeigh and his groups, the groups allied with his ideology, the Freemen in Montana. Are these guys descendants of those movements?
I think that they are conscious, in some cases, modification of that 90s militia moment. There are certainly common elements. If you look at members of the Boogaloo movement or members of decentralized kind of militia movements like the Three Percenters, if you look at the Oath Keepers, yes, there is this idea that the Second Amendment is sacred and that it's that the right to bear arms is under threat from left of center politicians in particular. There is a strong basis in other kinds of conspiracy theories. There is a sort of fundamentalist and idiosyncratic reading of the Constitution. And there is an idea that the federal government has usurped powers that more properly belong to either the states or even to figures like the local sheriff. But I think the difference is that the 90s militias were much more politically and socially marginal than the people who are involved in these movements now. In a very profound sense, all of that stuff has become much more mainstream, especially if you look at right-wing politics. I would encourage you and your listeners to go back and look at, you can find on YouTube the hearings that were held by a congressional committee, I forget which one, but during the 90s in the wake of that militia movement. And they were looking into this phenomenon in the wake of both Waco and then the bombing in Oklahoma City. And Republicans are clearly, the Republican members of the committee are clearly trying to distance themselves from these guys and are clearly actually genuinely appalled by some of the things that the militia groups have done. You're not going to find, look at the Kyle Rittenhouse situation, you're not going to find Republicans reflexively distancing themselves from these groups now. And look, I think if we look at the origins of the Oath Keepers and the origins of the Three Percenters, they both spring up really late in the 2000s, so 2008, 2009, and they're really most immediately a response to the election of President Barack Obama. So these kind of armed groups have been basically dormant for various reasons throughout the Bush administration, partly because they thrive on opposition to the federal government, partly because the war on terror was a kind of all-encompassing thing that didn't leave a lot of room on the right flank in some instances for these movements to spring up.